I'm Scott Dworkin, and you're listening to The Dworkin Report. My guest, Max Chafkin, is a journalist at Bloomberg Businessweek who wrote a probing book about one of America's most powerful and secretive tech billionaires. The Contrarian, Peter Thiel, and Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power is about the co-founder of PayPal, who went on to become a major influence in Facebook as an early investor and the founder of Palantir, a mass surveillance company with extensive government contracts. For Max Chafkin to take on the subject of reporting on a top Trump supporter who personally built bridges with Facebook's embattled CEO is no minor feat of journalistic courage. Consider that Thiel bankrupted the outlet Gawker by bankrolling a lawsuit against them in retribution for reporting on him. In this case, Max says that while he has heard Thiel takes issue with some of the reporting in his book, what he reveals is nothing short of stunning. Peter Thiel's role as the co-owner of Palantir, a government contractor who made a political visit to build bridges between Facebook, where he's a board member, to Jared Kushner at the White House, at a key moment before last year's election, amply demonstrates how central his influence was to Donald Trump's grip on power. The outcome of the meeting was that Mark Zuckerberg agreed to allow Trump's disinformation to stay on the ubiquitous social platform. Here's my interview with Max Chafkin. I'm here with author and journalist Max Chafkin, whose new book, The Contrarian, Peter Thiel, and Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power, just hit the shelves. Max, thanks for taking the time for the pod today. How are you?
Hey, thank you. Happy to be here.
Thanks. I wanted to start by asking you to introduce yourself, your journalistic career to our listeners and whatnot. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I've been basically covering the tech industry, as a reporter and editor for past 16 years. I'm at Bloomberg Businessweek right now, I got interested in this topic and the idea of writing a book about Peter Thiel just because, you know, he was everywhere in the tech industry, and I mean, initially that was kind of like the core interest. I mean, basically, I'd been covering this world for more than 10 years, and just seeing Peter Thiel kind of behind, inside, and around pretty much every big, you know, sort of venture capital deal, every company. And also, I think kind of more importantly, Peter Thiel as this kind of ideological, you know, lodestar for the industry, this person who kind of helped create a lot of the ideas and kind of the animating force behind the success of companies, you know, like Facebook, which of course Thiel had played a big role in as the first outside investor and key mentor to Mark Zuckerberg, longtime board member, and all that I think would be enough, you know, for a book. You know, he's arguably, you know, the most important figure in the tech industry, the most influential, but of course he also has this incredibly interesting kind of political life as both an early supporter of Donald Trump and kind of a key player in the rise of the alt-right, you know, far right. And I think who will be, you know, going forward, you know, a really important player in the political ecosystem. And I think that, you know, when you combine that with the fact that he's involved with these companies that just have an enormous influence over our lives, you know, I felt like somebody really had to do this book, had to kind of explore kind of what he believed and who he was, who he was all about. And you know, that's what I tried to do.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
And the Thiel runs a data company, I guess, with government contracts. What did you find out about that company that folks should know?
Yeah, so that company is called Palantir. It's incredibly controversial because it is a data mining company. It's founded not long after 9/11 in this kind of moment where, you know, we as a country and particular, you know, kind of the, you know, intelligence apparatus of the United States and the FBI were really feeling like we had missed warning signs that led to 9/11, that if we had just sort of looked at all the data that was being generated, you know, travel records, phone records, and so on, they might have been able to spot some of this money moving around. But might have been able to spot these terrorist cells, before they showed up. And that, of course, makes a lot of sense. And it was a very successful sales pitch that was made by Thiel and his allies. And the company has grown a lot since then. And I think this approach that Palantir follows, this data mining approach, has raised a lot of questions about privacy, because the thing about data mining is, it doesn't sound that bad to just, look at, who you were calling or like your travel records or whatever, or your Facebook data. All of that data doesn't sort of looks pretty benign. But when you have it and when you put it all together, you can learn a lot about somebody. So if somebody looks at, your Facebook data, they can tell probably, if you're pregnant, what's your sexuality? Are you cheating on your spouse? A lot of stuff that I think, that people don't actually explicitly put on Facebook, but which could be kind of inferred based on activity that you're doing. So that raises all sorts of privacy questions. And then there is this kind of a political question, because after Donald Trump is elected with a nice assist from Peter Thiel, Palantir, basically got on fire. It landed a whole host of government contracts, both with the U.S. military and with a bunch of key government agencies. And I think there are questions about to what extent those contracts were political, and to what extent they were, the result of having a founder and a majority or a major shareholder. Thiel is the biggest shareholder in Palantir, also have this important role in the Trump administration. So it's a successful defense contractor, but certainly a controversial one.
Curiosity, who gets access to that data? Can it be purchased, or how does that work?
Well, so what Palantir will say, and I think it's probably important to say this, is they don't actually control the data, right? But they make this software that makes it easy for various entities to look into data. And that data is going to depend on the client. So, if they're doing business with the federal government, right, then you assume the federal government has access to tons of, potential intelligence data and things like that. If they're doing business with your bank, as they do, they work with a lot of banks, then they're going to have access to, a bunch of your, banking records or whatever. But again, Palantir isn't necessarily seeing this. The people who are seeing it are the clients, and that, okay, so that might make you feel better, because assumedly it's like not like Peter Thiel is looking at your banking records. But then there's a question of, do you trust your bank? Do you trust U.S. intelligence? And at times, do you trust police departments? Palantir has worked with a lot of police departments, and at times Palantir has kind of, I would say, look the other way or failed to stop some really bad abuses. So in the book I talk about, there were these sales calls that the Palantir salespeople would go on, right, where they show off the software to like a police department, and inevitably somebody in that sales meeting would say, "Hey, can you look up my ex-girlfriend or something like that?" And the Palantir salespeople, as it was described to me, as I describe in the book, they would say, "Well, technically, you're not supposed to do that. But if you wanted to do that, so there's an extent to which it's not so much Palantir that might be violating our rights and our civil liberties. It's their clients. But ultimately, by creating the software, you're creating some of the opportunity to create these violations. And there's a question about kind of the overall industry, where maybe Palantir is behaving responsibly, but can we be sure that other that similar companies aren't sort of just taking it a step further and doing something slightly more questionable than what Palantir is doing. So there definitely are reasons to be concerned about privacy, although I think it's not only Palantir, it's part of an ecosystem that has put our privacy at risk.
Well, you also wrote in the book that Thiel was involved in setting up a meeting with Facebook owner Mark Zuckerberg, one of my best friends, Jared Kushner, and Donald Trump about the upcoming 2020 election back then. And I saw a report about that today as well. But can you tell us what happened and why it's important?
Yeah. So Thiel is a long-serving board member of Facebook, advisor to Mark Zuckerberg, kind of probably the most important kind of figure standing in between, Zuckerberg and the Trump administration. Facebook had been under a lot of pressure, both from Trump and from Trump's allies, to find ways to accommodate Trump. So there had been this kind of meme that was circulating in conservative circles and conservative media that said that Facebook was, you know, discriminating against conservatives, that they were not, you know, that they were squelching conservative voices, you know, banning people, that sort of thing. Now, I think that the general that complaint doesn't stand up to a lot of scrutiny. Conservatives have done very well on Facebook, as many you know, will tell you and as many told me. But that meme had definitely picked up steam, and it was something that Facebook was certainly worried about. And so in late 2019, Facebook is under a lot of pressure because the Trump campaign had run these ads that were sort of making stuff that were, you know, kind of stretching the truth about Hunter Biden. There were these posts where that had been doctored to make it look like Nancy Pelosi was, you know, there was something going on with her, you know, her well-being. And there was a lot of pressure from the left, from folks like Elizabeth Warren, for Facebook to crack down. Now, Zuckerberg, you know, gives this speech in October of 2019 where he sort of provides like an ideological defense of Facebook's decision to let Trump go. Then he goes to this meeting where it's Trump and Melania, Jared Kushner and Ivanka, Thiel and his husband, and Zuckerberg and his wife. And in that meeting, which is secret at the time, and we don't know exactly what happened, but Thiel afterwards told a friend, as I report in the book, that there had been an accommodation reached where Zuckerberg kind of said that he was going to continue to allow, you know, continue this policy of not fact-checking and would take a light hand, you know, against conservative media, which had been, you know, under some scrutiny around misinformation, things like that, and that the Trump administration in turn would go easy on Facebook, would stop, you know, railing, you know, Trump had been railing on Twitter, you know, that Facebook needed to be broken up, and so we don't know for sure what was discussed. Zuckerberg denied and has called this idea, you know, totally ridiculous. But what we do know is that not long after that meeting, Facebook creates this kind of new list of approved, you know, media outlets, one of which is Breitbart News, which, again, you can, you know, Breitbart News today is maybe a little bit more moderate than it was, you know, back when they had a special section of the site called Black Crime. But Breitbart News is pretty far out there. And there was this kind of general promotion, frankly, of these kind of hard right sites, and there was a lot of reporting that came out from BuzzFeed News showing that Facebook was kind of taking a light hand to regulating some of these figures, and you know, we saw this kind of conservative media ecosystem thrive on Facebook. Now, ultimately, and of course, Trump did not, you know, Trump didn't, you know, go any further, carry through on any of his threats. Now, Trump lost the election, and I think eventually after January 6th, Facebook kind of cracked down a little bit more. But I think, you know, for the most part, this alliance, you know, kind of worked, and it worked to both people's advantage. Now, Trump lost, but he didn't lose by that much, and Zuckerberg preserved his position, and I think, you know, of course, his, you know, the value of Facebook and the impact of Facebook only grew during the Trump presidency.
I agree. Well, a bunch of progressive groups, labor unions, progressive news outlets, we went I led a meeting to the DC Facebook office, and that was a few years ago. I need to find out the timing on that. But we met there, and then it was about not suspending progressive accounts and fake kind of suspensions or spam around it, and then delaying and having no process. It was kind of like Wizard of Oz. And so we wanted some kind of process behind that. Like, why are we being suspended, or why are we being removed? And so literally, I think it was a matter of days after that, my group's account got suspended, and it was just so frivolous because it was something about an article or a post from like 2 years before then. I just found it very eerie how controlling they were about that, and we call it the boot that they put on us. But anyways, I just found that interesting because we did have our meeting with them, and then after that, we did not have another one with them because it was just I don't understand exactly what they were trying to accomplish, but it wasn't helpful. And we decided to invest our money into other social media outlets and our time especially. But go ahead.
Yeah, well, one thing that story kind of brings up for me, I mean, so I'm guessing Zuckerberg was not in that meeting,
no,
right?
No.
So yeah, I mean, of course there's, Facebook is definitely talking to everybody, but there is something, you know, there was an equivalent meeting of that in 2016 where, you know, Zuckerberg was there, Thiel was there, you know, definitely they were taking the complaints of conservatives very seriously, maybe more seriously than they were taking, you know, concerns from progressives. And the other thing, you know, about these bans, I mean, you know, Facebook loves to talk about their policies as if they're very clear cut. And, you know, after, you know, my book came out, they, you know, there were responses that were like, well, you know, here's our policy. You know, we didn't agree to anything that Trump wanted because our policy had always been to not fact check politicians. But of course, like, these policies are subject to interpretation, and it's in the interpretation, you know, whether who gets banned, when they get banned, what justification is given, you know, that where sort of the rubber meets the road. And Facebook has a tendency to kind of fall back on this, like, very kind of, you know, presenting reporters and the public with like a very clear set of rules or something like that. But the rules are never, it's always a little bit muddier because there's always going to be kind of human judgments that come into play. And it's in those human judgments where the company is going to, you know, potentially shade things in one direction or another.
But we read your book. It also says Thiel has a significant ties, I guess, to neo-Nazi activists who rebranded themselves as alt-right. Who is Thiel? Why is Thiel an important figure for that community? And what do you think his goals are in meeting them?
Well, I think it's important to say, I think that slightly overstates what happened. I mean, I think Thiel, so he definitely was close to members of the alt-right. He definitely was exploring, you know, and meeting with some very out there people, you know, Milo Yiannopoulos, who was, you know, pretty far out there. He did not meet with Richard Spencer, who I think is probably, you know, more of a, like a neo-Nazi, or was a neo-Nazi anyway. I think he kind of drew the line there. Of course, you know, that's a pretty extreme, you know, I guess glad there was a line, but but like when your big defense is, well, hey, I didn't meet with Richard Spencer, you know, you've kind of gone pretty far down the rabbit hole. Now, I think Thiel has been, you know, very interested in these kind of far right provocateurs, people who are pushing the envelope of what you can say, or walking, you know, right up to the line on race or gender, and sometimes crossing it. So, you know, in college, when he ran this college newspaper, the Stanford Review, Thiel, you know, one of his close friends, this guy Keith Raboy, who is you know, very successful venture capitalist now, got into trouble for standing outside a faculty member's home and yelling a homophobic slur and shouting, "Hope you die of AIDS." And Thiel defended that as a free speech action, and as went after the administration for condemning that. You know, his editor, one of the editors at the Stanford Review, created a rape issue, you know, in 1992, when Thiel was still involved with the paper. That guy, David Sachs, is a major figure in Silicon Valley now. And, you know, that issue basically treated date rape as if it were kind of a fake thing. And so he's always been kind of pushing this stuff. So it's not that surprising, honestly, that when, you know, folks like Milo, you know, and et cetera, come out and start, you know, really pushing the envelope on race and, you know, on gender all over again, and getting really into Donald Trump, that Peter Thiel would be right there. I mean, and I think it's a big part of the reason why Thiel, you know, saw Trump as being somebody who could win the election. And I think with somebody like this, I mean, you have to, you know, of course, I think it's really important to scrutinize Thiel's ideology and his methods and criticize where appropriate. But I think even when you're criticizing, you have to respect it, right? Because he saw Trump when very few people realized that Trump was going to be this force. He saw that this kind of blend of, you know, provocation and nationalism and just like willingness to say, you know, whatever, and that would be powerful. And he attached himself to Trump before a lot of the kind of mainstream, you know, Republican establishment, you know, saw it, for better or worse.
Hey everyone, we finally have podcast subscriptions. Get exclusive subscribers-only podcasts with interviews, our personal opinions on current events, and coming soon, early access to our public releases for only $6.99 a month. Subscribe on Anchor right now. Right, and you know, he has a short background, I guess, in South Africa. Allegedly he told two of his classmates at Stanford, he denies this claim, but that he thought South Africa's former apartheid system of government was a quote unquote sound economic system. Again, he denies that claim. But going backwards, do you think anything in his background growing up in South Africa and Southern Africa during the apartheid era affects what we're seeing from him today or at all?
So I think, you know, you gotta separate, you know, the sort of actions of his parents with himself. You know, I mean, he wound up in South Africa and Southwest Africa, modern day Namibia, you know, at a uranium mine where his father worked. And, you know, of course, mining uranium in South Africa in the 1970s has serious political implications, because South Africa was doing that because they wanted to get a nuclear weapon, and they wanted a nuclear weapon because they wanted to preserve the apartheid system. But that doesn't, you know, again, that's Thiel's a child during that period. So I don't think, I'm not sure that we can ascribe, you know, we can ascribe all of that to him. But I do think that having that background caused him to react, you know, in a very specific way when he got to Stanford, because you get to Stanford, right? And, the anti-apartheid activism was like a really major force on college campuses, you know, all around the country, right? It's something that liberals were really enthusiastic about. And I think somebody like Thiel, who, you know, is a little, you know, who had that background, who kind of felt like the world was against him, was apt to take that as kind of a personal attack, as not just an attack on, you know, on an idea and an economic system, but as something that personally said something about him. And I think that may be part of the reason that, you know, for those comments that you registered. I also think it's important to say, you know, back then, the defending apartheid was something that a lot of, you know, you heard that on college campuses, that, oh, this is an economic system and, you know, we shouldn't get involved with that. And I think it's important to remember that Thiel, as much as a, you know, political rabble rouser he was really swimming in a stream where that kind of thing was encouraged. So he was, you know, his newspaper, the Stanford Review, was, you know, kind of modeled after the Dartmouth Review, which is the Dinesh D'Souza, you know, newspaper, started, you know, just a couple of years earlier. There's also the Cornell Review, which is Ann Coulter. So there's a whole kind of school of kind of bomb throwing conservatives who rose up during that era and kind of helped create the vocabulary and the language and even some of the methods that we saw, you know, deployed by Donald Trump and by the right, you know, starting in 2016.
I could talk to you for hours, brother. Last two questions. Have you met Peter Thiel before? And also, has he had any thoughts on the book?
Yeah. So I approached this as kind of a journalistic project. You know, I'm talking to, of course, you know, friends, his former colleagues, his former employees, his, you know, his classmates, you know, anyone who would talk to me, but also, of course, Peter Thiel. And I approached him through a PR representative very early in the process and, you know, had a lot of back and forth, and actually met with him while I was, you know, reporting the book off the record. You know, can't share any of the details. And what I can tell you is he, you know, declined ultimately to offer me anything on the record. He also, you know, at the end of the process, again, because I'm, you know, this is like a kind of standard journalism, but, you know, presented his, you know, PR person with a, you know, a long list of fact-checking questions. And again, no response. I've heard through intermediaries, he's read the book. I think he takes issue with some of it, although he hasn't said anything specific. I mean, what we have seen is some of his allies have come out and attacked the book, as I totally expected, because the thing is, you know, Thiel has kind of created this mythology, and the mythology works both ways, by the way. There's the kind of Peter Thiel as the kind of right wing villain that you sometimes see on the left, and also Peter Thiel as this like Ayn Randian Superman who's a builder and a great man of ideas. And I think for his allies, the extent to which the book, you know, undermines, you know, both of those mythologies, which of course both contain truth but are not the truth, I think that is very upsetting. And there is this kind of, you know, unspoken agreement in Silicon Valley, right, that everyone needs to, you know, be extra nice to Peter Thiel. So because he has a lot of power, and to the extent that the book is critical, that has generated some backlash. But it's backlash that I'm happy is there, because I really want there to be a conversation about this. I think this person is very powerful. The companies he's behind, you know, are too powerful just to kind of ignore. And so happy to have that debate.
The book is Contrarian, Peter Thiel and Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power. Buy it now via the link in the episode's notes. And I don't say that about books very often, as y'all know. Max Chafkin, you can follow him online on Twitter at CHAFKIN. Thank you very much, Max. I hope you come back on the show in the near future, and I appreciate your book. Thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. Happy to do it anytime. This was really, really fun.
Thanks again to Max Chafkin for taking the time. Thanks to the best producer in the world, Grant Stern. You can follow him at Grant Stern on Twitter. You can visit our website at dworkinreport.com for more episodes. Thanks again for listening.
Onward!